And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Last month, Congress funded $120 billion to sustain the troops in Iraq. But in doing so, spending, in effect, $1 billion a day for 4 months, were they sustaining the troops? Were they supporting the troops? Or were they betraying the troops? What do the troops want? What do they think about this war that's already the third longest war in United States history, having lasted longer than World War II, World War I, the Civil War, Korea? Are we going anywhere? Are we achieving anything? And what is it that the troops tell themselves to keep them going? Do they tell themselves we're stopping weapons of mass destruction when there aren't any there? Do they tell themselves that we were there because of 9/11 when Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11? Or are we fighting for freedom? Just sort of use that one word, fighting for freedom for the people of Iraq when apparently we're not fighting for the people of Darfur. They're difficult questions, and there's also the very tough question that, frankly, John Kerry asked 35 years ago after the war in Vietnam. How do you be the last man to die for a mistake? How do you tell someone to continue to fight for a mistake? When so many of our troops have died, how can you tell other troops that their death was in vain? Do we have to keep fighting the war in order to preserve their memories? Or would losing 3,000 more lives just be more throwing lives away? They're tough questions. I don't have any easy answers. In fact, it's as hard questions as they are, it's even harder to answer these questions. But John Boone, sitting next to me, is going to try to do that. He is an Iraqi war vet. He served his country in the battles in Iraq. And I want to thank you for coming here again on the Inside Scoop.
Well, thanks for having me back, Mark. I appreciate it.
Let's start with where we are now. I mean, we'll talk about where we've come and all this stuff. But where we are right now, there's Bush's surge. And Congress has said, give the surge a chance. Almost like the 60s activists used to say, give peace a chance. They're saying, give war a chance. Give it a chance. We might just eke it out. How do you respond to that?
Well, personally, I think if there was ever going to be a time for a surge or more troops, it should have been in the very beginning. It should have been when General Colin Powell went to President Bush and said, listen, you're going to have to use the Powell Doctrine on this one. You're going to have to go in there with overwhelming force in order to win the peace, along with the advice of former Army Chief of Staff General Eric Shinseki, when he went in and said it's going to take several hundred thousand troops to pacify Iraq and successfully complete this mission. The president completely ignored their advice. He relied on the advice of Donald Rumsfeld, of Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith.
And Shinseki lost his job.
And Shinseki lost his job. And he totally ignored the military commanders who warned him about the aftermath. And
so if we had a chance to succeed, it was 4 years ago when we started this war.
Absolutely. If we were ever going to succeed in this war by using an overwhelming number of troops, that ship has sailed, Mark.
And today, why won't it succeed? If it would have worked 4+ years ago, why not
work
now?
Mark, too much damage has been done. Our military is completely overstretched. It's not, I mean, months ago we were arguing that our military was on its way to being broken. It's past that now. General Peter Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, himself has acknowledged that our military ground forces are stretched so thin that if there were another crisis, we could not adequately respond to it.
You mean here in the United States?
Here in the United States, because all of our troops, if you're in active duty, well, I mean, not even active duty, if you're a member of the United States Army, whether it's active duty, National Guard, reserve capacity, or Marine, if you're not scheduled to rotate into Iraq, you're probably already over there. And the Marines and the soldiers that are here in the United States are scheduled to go there and relieve those fellow troops. And when those troops come home, they're immediately put on standby to go back. I mean, it's just this back-and-forth situation.
You know what? I have a clip from 60 Minutes, and I want to give them credit for it. But it shows exactly what you're talking about, and I want to get your comment on it. Now, I know you haven't seen this clip, so you'll be seeing it for the first time.
Sure.
I want to know what you think about these troops and what they're going through.
Sure.
By New Year's 2007, The Iowa Guard had run more than 300 missions and covered 2.5 million miles. They'd suffered 2 killed in action and 25 wounded. But the end of the road was in sight. There were only 2 months to go before they would all head home.
It's getting to the point where, you know, you don't want to mess up. You don't want to mess up and you or one of your buddies get hurt. You know, it's too late in the game, you know, for somebody to lose an arm, lose a leg, you know, lose a life. We're kind of in the home stretch now, and that will be home soon, so should go by quick, hopefully.
Responsibility. But that hope was dashed in an instant.
It is clear that we need to change our strategy in Iraq.
President Bush announced the troop surge, and General Dardis asked the families to gather in a National Guard hangar.
The Department of Defense announced yesterday that the 1st BCT, 34th Division, would have their tour extended for up to 125 days.
Our National Guard guys, they're not active Army. What about the families that have to, you know, the mothers that have sons over there, the wives that have kids? What about them? These men got to be gone for 2 years away from their family?
I agree with you. I think it is. I think it's too long. I couldn't agree with you more.
Ladies, they're going to be home in August. Maybe. Are you just saying that to us? Are you giving us 60 days, 90 days?
We're ready to make a change.
The countdown for Daddy coming home. Now we have nothing. Nothing at all.
Families who were expecting their soldiers to come home in April would now have to wait for August. Margot Bodensteiner broke the news to specific.
Okay, so here you have very, very powerful families that you hear the troops say, we're ready to come home, we're excited sure. about coming home, the families are waiting, you know, and what's interesting to me is the woman in the audience. Well, let me ask, before I even go on, what was your reaction to what you just said?
Well, I words can't express, you know, the sympathy that I feel for that poor woman. I mean, this is how the administration has conducted this war from day one. They never went in there with enough troops.
And yet, John, the administration says that this is all about supporting our troops. They actually were threatening the Democrats who passed 2 bills
sure.
to set withdrawal dates, and he vetoed both of them.
Sure.
And the Democrats, finally, the president was saying, look, if you don't give us this money, you are against our troops. You are not supporting our troops. And yet, although the Democrats caved and Congress passed the money for the troops, I have to ask myself, what would this woman want? What would the troops want? Do they want to stay?
By my perception of that woman and her emotions wholeheartedly lead me to believe that she really wished that the Democrats were probably a little bit more tougher on President Bush and fought a little harder and stood their ground and tried to push through legislation that would require the president to bring the troops home.
Let me show you what some of the veterans themselves were sure. saying when they heard the news.
Finally, word comes through.
Our brigade, that's us, as will be deployed, extended up to 125 days, starting April. So that takes us August time frame.
It's really, really hard to, you know, try to keep doing this mission and you got everything at home going on and everybody's moving on with their life.
There's no way I'm re-enlisting. I love my family too much and I hope to get home, settle down and start a family. I can't handle this anymore.
Obviously, there's a lot of pressure.
Sure, Mark,
among the troops.
And those troops are well within their limits to feel that way. Ever since the first year of the invasion, troops have been involuntarily extended against their will. They have been stop loss. Troops that enlisted and honorably fulfilled their enlistment. And when they're getting ready to get out and move on with their lives, they're being told, no, you're going to go to Iraq. And then when they get to Iraq, like I said, their missions get, their tours of duty get extended involuntarily. Just recently, we've seen it. I mean, Army deployments have been extended from 12 to 15 months. And when I look at these soldiers, or these troops in this 60-minute segment, it is 60 minutes,
yes,
correct?
Yes, it is 60 minutes.
I mean, it just doesn't even seem to me like like they really believe in what's going on over there. It seems to me that they're more concerned about their personal survival and the survival of their fellow troops.
Well, I'm glad you raised that because some of them very much still believe in the mission, and I want to play some of them for you too.
Great.
Hear what
sure.
they have to say.
Absolutely.
Guardsmen, though, there's no moving.
Here we go. Oh, we've got technical problems. I hate when that happens. But that's life. That happens. So we'll get that back working in
sure.
a second.
Tell you what, let's take a break if we can. We'll also get a chance for our callers to call in. Folks, if you want to join in the discussion, if you want to ask John a question, who served honorably but is ready to bring this war to a close, the toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back after this.
History has demonstrated that violence only begets greater violence. And injustice only begets greater injustice.
For the guardsmen, though, there's no moving.
This is not how we want the United States to be known around the world. We have another tradition that we think ought to prevail. One that is more just and more powerful. There is a better way. If we truly want peace and security, then we must work hard for justice.
If you're concerned that we've become a nation whose national policies are grounded in beliefs that are centered on a lie embedded in BS, then don't miss Escape from Orwellian Nation, a talk show in which concerned regular citizens like you and me, not self-serving media spinmeisters, wade through the barrage of newspeak and doublethink that pollutes public discourse today. Big Brother, big business, big media, and the big national parties who collude to keep we the people afraid and in the dark would prefer that you not watch. Show them who's in charge. Tune in to Escape from Orwellian Nation right here on Channel 10.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. My guest is former Iraqi Army veteran John Bruins. We're talking about the morale of the troops. What are they thinking? How do they get up in the morning? Because you have to, when you get up in the morning and you have to face death day by day, it's hard. I assume, you have to believe in your mission, don't you, or to even get out of bed?
Sure.
Did you find days when you were in Iraq when it was hard to get out of bed because you're like, we're not succeeding? I mean, how was that for you?
Well, when I went into Iraq, I mean, I could tell, from the very beginning that just me personally, I just never felt that the situation over there was going to work. I mean,
what made you feel that way?
Well, I could tell you that after the invasion was over and the shock and awe, the first Iraqis that started to protest our presence in their country were the Shiite Muslims, the people that Saddam oppressed. And I started
the Shiites.
The Shiites, absolutely.
The majority, the ones who we were putting in power.
Absolutely.
They were objecting.
They conducted a holy pilgrimage to Karbala, something that was outlawed by Saddam, and who found freedom that we gave them. And they used that pilgrimage as a direct protest of our presence in their country. And it was very...
disturbing for you because you thought they would greet you as liberators, or at least be happy.
It was very, very discouraging, to say the least, because I knew I'd have a fight on my hands if Saddam's enemies clearly did not want me there.
Now, you volunteered to join the military, right?
Yes, twice. Yes.
After September 11th, when did you first?
I joined the reserves when I was going to college.
What years is that?
1996.
Okay.
And my time in the reserve was coming to an end, and 9/11 happened. Like I said, I viewed that as my generation's Pearl Harbor. I mean, it was.
It was.
And you know, I believe that the war in Afghanistan was right.
So you signed up after September 11th to fight the people that killed 3,000 men.
Sure. I reenlisted. I changed my military occupational specialty from a non-combat role to infantry, you know, from the reserve in a non-combat role to infantry and active duty, purposely to go after bin Laden and people who attacked us. And instead, I was sent to Iraq.
So you thought you'd be sent to Afghanistan?
I thought I'd be sent to Afghanistan. And instead, I was sent. My morale was somewhat low when I was there because, I knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction. I knew Saddam had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda or 9/11. I knew that he did not want war with our country, and I just did not understand why President Bush was so strong in his willingness to send us in there.
Let me play for you what other troops are saying about what you've just said.
Sure.
It's very interesting to me to see the wide range of views on this
story. Sure, yeah.
Because I think some of them are believing still the lies. Let me play for you.
Sure.
Invital but many, especially the younger ones, are questioning the war. Mike Itis and his son Josh used to be on the same page.
I have the sense here that you guys don't see eye to eye on the war.
That would be a true statement.
There's a difference of opinion. Josh, tell me, what are you thinking?
I just feel that we will be here a long time, and it's going to take a lot more time than what people think back home to fix what's going on over here. From what I see, they don't want us here.
Mike, you disagree with that?
Yeah, I believe that we're supposed to be over here. Progress is being made. If you go back to 9/11 and what the people did there, and when the president asked, do you want me to go after these people? The whole United States stood up in unison and said, yes, we do. He says, this is going to be long and drawn out. Are you really sure you're going to stand with me? And they said, yes, we will. Well, now there are some that aren't, because the American people are a give-me people, and give it to me now.
You're a little bit angry that the folks of home have turned against the war.
Oh, you can say that.
More than a little bit.
Well, as I said, I believe in what we're doing.
Get to other troops. There's Mike, and he's upset with people who want to end the war. He believes in what we're doing. He said the president said we'd be in there for the long haul. I'm ready to go. Where's the American people?
Well, first of all, at least he's putting his money where his mouth is and putting his own physical body where his rhetoric is. Unlike a lot of Americans who support the war wholeheartedly but just don't have the guts to fight it, As much as I respect his service, I totally have to disagree. He made a statement that after 9/11, the American people got up and said, President Bush, we're with you, you know, whatever it takes. But what's so tragic about that is that President Bush painted a false picture to the American people of who the enemy really was.
That's what I find fascinating about
right.
Mike. The Taliban attacks us, Al-Qaeda attacks us with the support of the Taliban, the support of Afghanistan, and he conflates it with the war in Iraq.
Right.
He doesn't make a distinction. He says, 9/11 they attacked, and we have to fight. In America, you said you'd be there for the long haul, and we did. I certainly defended sending
sure.
our troops to Afghanistan. 90,
absolutely.
Every member of Congress, save one, voted for that war.
Sure.
And he's like, where are you? And I would say to him, well, where are you? You're not in Afghanistan.
Right.
You're in Iraq.
You're in Iraq, and basically, you know, this is something that is not easy for me to say, but I really believe that this was a war that was constructed by neocon intellectuals, like I said, such as Wolfowitz and Pearl and Feith. And you know what this is? This is a failed neoconservative experiment. They had some sort of grand plan for the Middle East. It did not work. Their experiment backfired, and we have created more enemies than we can count.
Okay, but now we have troops, and they're there.
Yes.
And they need to believe in their mission because, I mean, every day, it shows on this 60 Minutes, the longer episode, they're driving in these convoys, and it's boring. You're just driving in the convoy day after
yeah.
day across the road looking for a thin wire
sure.
across that can kill you.
Yeah.
So you need to, like, stare at the road very carefully every minute for thousands of hours and not miss that wire
right.
or you're dead.
Sure.
I mean, it's not a very fun video game.
No,
much
not
less
at all.
Real life.
Not at all.
So, but this guy's saying, I believe in the mission. I want to fight for the mission. And you know what's interesting to me? I think some people psychologically
need that kind of thing to sustain them.
It's very possible, in
order to have your morale, we have all kinds of lies we use to sustain ourselves. I mean, we have all kinds of, you know, someone who's terminally ill, someone in a coma, they're going to get better, when we know that 99% of the time they don't.
Right.
But people use all kinds of ways to try to believe in themselves. And what's interesting to me is this guy seems to really need to believe that he's fighting for a good cause.
Sure.
Did you find a lot of that among your fellow troops in Iraq?
Absolutely. When I was in Iraq, it was during the first year of the invasion. And this was before the lies were exposed. You know, were exposed. But I think now you see the
tide. So what did people say they were fighting there at that time?
Oh.
For WMDs? What were they saying?
You know, first it was WMDs. And then next thing you know, like, all the troops just seemed to have this mentality that it was Al-Qaeda. It was Al-Qaeda. And let me just paint a brief picture. Part of what we did as infantrymen in Iraq were like cordoned searches. What we would do is let's say a roadside bomb goes off in a community, or there was, you know, a high level of attacks on U.S. soldiers in a community, and a battalion commander would reasonably, he was well within his limits to say, hey, you know, I believe that there's insurgent activity. Let's go in and, you know, let's go in the middle of the night and we'll quarantine the area and we'll go door to door. Well, these soldiers, these young kids, 18, 19, 20-year-old infantrymen, when we close down those areas and we kick in the doors in the middle of the night and we rip the man of the house out of the bed and we throw his family in a room and they're afraid, the man is just beside himself with how he feels he's being treated and how his family's being treated. And, you know, I'm telling my interpreter, hey, ask him if he has any weapons in here. Ask him if he's connected to the insurgency. You know, we're looking for any clues at all that would lead us to find the people who are attacking us. But in the meantime, you know, you dump his couch. I mean, you flip his couch over. You dump his closets. You dump his drawers. And you leave his house looking like a hurricane.
You don't clean it up afterwards, do you?
Right, no. But those soldiers, they go in there with the mentality as if they are going after Bin Laden himself. And
so
it's just
they treat these civilians as if they're Bin Laden.
Well,
there are
high levels of activity in the area, and they just get, you know, they just go in there like they're going after the enemy. But, you know,
I would think there'd be two reactions. That,
right.
Particularly, I mean, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, these are people who are, you know, just new adults. They used
to
be kids.
Sure.
I mean, they're still kind of forming what they believe. I would think for some of them, they would do as you say, you know, this is the enemy, not really like this. I mean, this older gentleman, I mean, you don't have to be 20 years old. This guy's, it looks like he's in his 40s.
Sure.
And is still conflating Bin Laden and 9/11 and the attacks on New York as if they had something to do with Iraq.
Right.
We all know they had nothing to do with Iraq. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq then. There is now. Some, I think, would take that approach, and others, I would think, would be horrified.
But
by watching a woman clutch her baby,
absolutely,
saying, don't hurt my child. Did you find both of that in the military?
Well, what I found was, Mark, is that the man of the house, he would react to that.
In a very strong, active, loud,
you know,
angry way.
If he was not involved in the insurgency, you can assume that the next day after this situation took place, that he would join the insurgency. And whenever this man reacts to somebody breaking into his home and treating his family in a certain way, he fights back, and then President Bush says, Al-Qaeda, 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 and he keeps drilling that in to the heads of the American people, when it's quite the contrary. It's Iraqi people attacking U.S. troops because they feel occupied. Just recently, Senator Joe Lieberman made a visit to Iraq, and he engaged in some in-depth discussions with soldiers from the 82nd Airborne. And they told Senator Lieberman very boldly, they said, sir, if you send more troops in here, it's just more targets. When are we going to get out of here?
In other words, they thought...
We're driving around waiting to get shot.
That the activity, the violence, would actually decrease
if
American troops were to leave.
They did, and it's quite the contrary, Mark. Today on the front page of the Washington Post...
We have it here.
Major General James Simmons said that it's you can't argue it. In the past few weeks, as the surge has been taking place, attacks on U.S. troops have risen, and they've been more effective.
It's right here. Attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq grow in lethality and complexity. And he points out that the troops in Iraq the number of attacks against U.S. forces is up. They've grown more effective. Insurgents are deploying huge, deeply buried munitions set up to protect their territory, complex ambushes. It's getting worse.
It's getting worse. And I don't see
how the death toll is rising.
Right. The death toll is rising. I mean, we just lost, Mark, 14 more U.S. troops over the weekend. In May, we had 127 U.S. troops killed in Iraq. That's the third deadliest month since the war began. I don't see how you can argue this.
Well, I know that some do. I mean, we have people that come on the show that say, well, look at Anbar. There's tremendous success in Anbar province.
Can I make a comment about
that? Please, go right ahead.
I didn't debate, but I had a conversation with a Marine captain on C-SPAN on Memorial Day, and we discussed military operations in Iraq, and he was touting with great pride that in Anbar, the Marines have been able to recruit former allies of the insurgency, some who have been allied with al-Qaeda, who now have just magically and miraculously changed their mind and decided that they want to join forces with the United States. And we are recruiting them.
That makes me nervous.
Yeah,
we're going to train them how to kill us.
We are recruiting members, former members of the insurgency and former members of al-Qaeda, as far as we know they're former members, to somehow outsource the mission of defeating al-Qaeda and al-Anbar, and today...
That's right, really scary. One reason Bin Laden knows what he knows
right.
is we helped arm him in Afghanistan 20
right.
years ago against the Soviet Union.
And today, this morning on Fox News, Ryan Crocker, our ambassador to Iraq, he had said that they are in the United States and the Iraqi government right now is engaged in a political reconciliation with the insurgency, and they are giving very deep thought in regard to accepting people, Iraqi people who have previously killed Americans. Now, I thought we had to go to Iraq because we had to
prevent them from killing Americans.
We had to fight them, and now we're recruiting them.
It
just doesn't make any sense to me, and I just can't understand how people can go along with this and say that's supportive of the troops. I think it's ridiculous.
Let me suggest to you the reason. And it's got nothing to do with troops on the ground. It has nothing to do with al-Qaeda. It has nothing to do with the surge or all the stuff that you're talking about, Anbar province. Let me suggest to you that it's a psychological reason, that it's the same reason we stayed in Vietnam, which became America's longest war, that people don't want to admit that thousands of Americans have given their lives for a mistake. People don't want to think that they've wounded and lost an arm and a leg for a mistake.
Sure.
People don't want to feel like they've wasted 2 years of their life and haven't watched their children grow up for a mistake. Americans don't want to feel like they've spent $1 trillion, you can have double the taxes, for a mistake. And so they say, we're not going to surrender. How can we surrender if we do that? It was all a mistake. I want to focus on the psychological issues when we come back.
Sure.
Toll-free number, 888-488-MARK. 888-488-6275. Join in the debate. Be right here after this.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
My name is David Bell. I am a resident of Virginia's 11th Congressional District, and I ask Representative Tom Davis to initiate or support investigations into violations of the law by President Bush and his administration.
Tom Davis, my name is Jean Reynolds, and I'm one of your constituents. I want you to join immediately with other members of Congress to begin an investigation of the criminal acts that George Bush has committed.
I'm Nick Spengler of Ashland, Virginia, and I would like our troops to come home and Bush to get out of office.
My name is Nancy Maynard. I live in the 11th Congressional District, and this message is for Tom Davis. I'm asking you to please investigate for impeachment.
My name is Bruce Smith. I live in the 11th Congressional District in Woodbridge, Virginia. I want Congressman Davis to support the investigation of President Bush and Vice President Cheney and those that foisted this war on us.
Hello, Congressman Davis. I'm Carrie Plonson from the 11th Congressional District, and I'd like you to take immediate action to investigate George Bush and his offenses in leading this country into a war that's unwarranted and there is no solution for.
We have to impeach. I am just appalled that we would not, quote, waste our time with impeachment. The message to the world has to be that Bush and Cheney are guilty of international war crimes about which we can't do anything. We can do a lot about the crimes committed within the U.S. Constitution.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest is John Bruins. He's a former Army veteran. He fought in Iraq, and he has very different views of the war now. Now, I don't know, when you first came in, John, were you far more supportive? I mean, I assume, I know you wanted to fight in Afghanistan.
I did.
So already you kind of felt like it was a bait and switch for you.
Sure.
But then, at least, did you think, well, okay, I'll go to Iraq and do some good there?
I was against the Iraq war before we went in.
Wow, okay.
But, I mean, I paid attention to the news and what was going on, Hans Blix and the UN weapons inspectors, and what they were reporting back to the UN, that they could not substantiate what President Bush's accusations against Saddam.
Now, this is really interesting to me. You were paying attention. A few Americans were paying attention.
Sure.
Most of us weren't. My guess is most troops were not paying the attention you were. Is that fair to say?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, maybe some of the troops that were paying attention weren't buying into it. I mean, Colin Powell is a very respected individual among the military community. And when he got in front of the United Nations and made that case,
sure,
all members of the military bought that hook, line, and sink.
Let me play for you. It's very interesting.
Sure.
Someone who has changed their mind. 60 Minutes interviewed him today.
Sure.
And then they showed an interview from 2 years ago.
Okay.
Where he said, we're fighting for freedom. Let me play that.
Okay.
We also noticed a change in the Wendling brothers, Adam and Andy.
Well, I think at home, there's a lot of misconception about the conflict over here. They'll be asked what they believe the war in Iraq is about, and they'll just say freedom. They'll just spout off with something that they've heard, and it's easily repeatable, and it's patriotic.
That reminded us of what he told us in Iowa almost 2 years ago.
What does the Iraq war mean to you?
Well, I think it's about, you know, stepping into a situation where, like, a lot of people didn't have, you know, the freedoms that we are afforded every day. If I could look back 3 years ago on what I believed in, what my ideals were, and what I thought about my life in the world, you know, I'd probably just be looking at a 180.
Yeah, a lot of times I wonder if we ever should have, you know, gotten involved to begin with. And obviously the situation as it is now and the way things have changed, you know, it's not going to be anything that we can get out of anytime soon.
Okay, so this guy shows a complete 180. They showed him 2 years ago, we want to fight for other people's freedom, which is a noble concept.
Sure.
Let me just say, and certainly in World War II, the greatest generation fighting the Nazis, I don't think you'd find too many in America today that would say that was an unjust or wrong war. You know, I myself would like to send troops to Darfur if we had them, frankly, because of the genocide going
sure
on there. So he's fighting for their freedom, but then 2 years later, he's derisive of Americans that say we're fighting for freedom.
Sure.
Did you see a lot of people change their minds over the course of your year in Iraq?
Yes. I think in the very beginning, in the early stages of the war, I think the Bush administration was very effective in their PR campaign to the American people in the ways in which they sold this war. But, Mark, we're well into our fifth year. You know, there were no WMDs. We removed Saddam. We trained an Iraqi military. We gave them 3 democratic elections. And the violence has not stopped. The killings have not stopped. There is an all-out Sunni and Shia sectarian civil war. And these troops are out there patrolling the same streets, doing the same exact kind of missions over and over and over again. And they don't feel like they're making progress. And, I mean, if you look at the situation now, I mean, if you were to poll, do a poll in Iraq, and there have been polls done, the majority of the Iraqi people want us to leave there. These troops probably don't feel appreciated, and they don't feel probably as if they are protecting Americans, American freedom here at home. How are the Iraqis going to somehow take over the United States and take away our freedom? That's just ludicrous.
Well, you know, but George Bush will say that. He'll say, we're fighting over there so we don't have to fight here. And again, all I have to do is look at today's Washington Post, and we see right here, New York Airport, target of plot, officials say. So they're still plotting against us.
And Mark, the people that these terrorists that were going to attack JFK Airport, they were from the Caribbean. They were from South. They were from South America. They weren't even of Muslim descent. And then you take a look at the previous attempt that was just halted at Fort Dix. Terrorists were going to go into Fort Dix, New Jersey,
right,
and kill U.S. troops. And I mean, not that long ago, the British uncovered a terror plot in London, where terrorists were going to get on airplanes and try to crash them in the Atlantic
Ocean.
It's
a strange concept. Yeah. It makes you think that the administration thinks there's this limited body of terrorists. There's 4,233 terrorists,
right,
and it's like shooting ducks in a gallery, or playing a video game where you have only so many space invaders. And, and if you kill one, there's one less terrorist.
Right.
Instead of understanding, as you pointed out, when you go in somebody's home and throw
out
a
bunch of terrorists.
You create more terrorists.
Right.
Then we destroy. Do you think we're doing that?
No. Well, I mean, you take a look at these three cases we just cited. We have one at JFK Airport. We have one at Fort Dix. We had one in London. These aren't Iraqis, Mark. These are not Iraqis. So much for fighting them in Iraq so we don't have to fight them over here. The people in Iraq are fighting us because they don't want a foreign military over there. George Bush will just say, that's Al-Qaeda who's doing it. But it's quite the contrary.
Well, let's say it's not Al-Qaeda. I mean, can an argument be made that when we leave Iraq, there is a sectarian civil war?
Sure.
It's already started. When we leave, then the bloodbath will really begin, and the Shiites and the Sunnis will completely massacre each other. And heck, it'll be our fault because Saddam Hussein, as bad as he was a relatively stable dictatorship. So as Colin Powell once famously said, if you break it, you bought it.
Sure.
We clearly broke it. Why haven't we bought it?
Well, and just to echo what Colin Powell said, President Bush's father said the same thing.
Right.
He said that's the reason why we didn't go all the way in 91 was because there would be no viable exit strategy.
But here's the thing. It's very interesting. I've seen the Republican rhetoric change. Very, very few people will today defend us going in the first place. I have Republicans on my show, and I ask them about going in the first place, and they dodge, and they weave, and they spin, and they won't answer my question, but they'll say, all right, whether or not it was a mistake, and I'm not conceding it was, what do we do now? And if we leave, won't there be a bloodbath? Isn't there an argument there?
That is a very, very legitimate argument. And my only answer is whether we stay there 10 more weeks, 10 more months, or 10 more years. This is a
problem. The bloodbath will come
The bloodbath will come. You know, maybe it will, maybe it won't. It's more highly probable that it will. But whether we stay there or whether we go, they are going to continue to fight each other. And the worst part about it is that both warring factions want to kill our troops, too.
And that's, so at least they'll just be killing each other and not us in the middle.
And it's just unfair to...
You know, I bring up that in the 1980s, Iran and Iraq killed 1 million people in the last great Sui-Shiite war.
Right.
And there was nothing good to say about that except that we weren't there. We were helping them kind of in the background,
right,
but we didn't have troops on the ground there.
Sure.
But let me ask you the question I asked before the break, because I don't have an easy answer for this.
I probably don't either.
Well, no, I actually think there is one. But here's a guy, you or anyone else, or a woman, and he or she has seen his or her colleagues die, friends of his or hers, try their best, good, young, courageous American men and women, and they've died. Or here's a vet who's been injured, who's lost his limbs. Lost his arms, lost his legs. If we leave Iraq now, it would be admitting defeat. It would be telling the soldiers who are wounded, telling the families of the soldiers who died, it was all a waste. We accomplished nothing. Your son, your daughter, they fought honorably. They're honorable people, but they're dead for no good reason. And let me suggest to you that one of the reasons we're fighting this war today is the same reason we fought that war in Vietnam. We're doing so not because we're achieving anything, but because we don't want to admit to ourselves that we haven't achieved anything.
Mark, those soldiers that died in Iraq and the soldiers that have lost their limbs, they did that for each other. They did that for the fellow troops to the right and left of them. That's basically what it comes down to. When you're over there and things get violent and the fighting starts, you do it for your fellow troops. The accusations of troops dying in vain, they should be directed at the Bush administration.
But see, here's the thing. You look at the widow crying about the loss of her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are men. There are some women that have died, but most of the deaths are men. And if we withdraw now, they will call it surrender. And they will say, my son died in vain. Now, what's interesting, if we continue it now, we might have 3,000 more deaths and 10,000 more wounded,
sure,
and another trillion more spent, and then we'll have twice as many who've died in vain. But then 10 years from now, when we have 20,000 dead and 3 trillion spent and hundreds of thousands of wounded, they'll say, we can't stop now. We have hundreds of thousands of wounded and 2 trillion spent and 10,000 dead.
Right.
If anything, the sunk cost increase. It's one of those things we actually learned in economics. It's called sunk cost. That,
sure,
that basically, if you spend $1,000 on a bad land deal,
mm-hmm,
okay, don't double down. Don't throw good money after bad. Don't say, well, if I admit I've lost the money, I'll be upset that I've lost the money, so I'll put another $1,000 in and hope I'll somehow succeed. Cut your losses. But that's exactly what the Republicans are accusing the Democrats of, cutting and running. And they're saying, in effect, you don't support our troops because you're not giving them a chance to succeed. The same argument they made in Vietnam. That's a very emotional argument. How do you get out of the emotions and get into the logic, the facts? I don't have an answer for that. I was hoping you would.
Well, Mark, it's very tough. You know, it's extremely difficult for somebody like myself who fought in Iraq, who's very proud of my military service. I've served honorably. It's just very difficult for me to come home and say our soldiers have died in vain. I look at it this way, and I don't want to sound repetitive. The way that I look at it is that we were forced into that war by the Bush administration, and we died for each other. We died for our fellow troops to the right and the left of us. As far as the Republican-controlled, well, not the Republican-controlled Congress.
They don't control Congress anymore.
Thankfully,
the administration.
Thankfully. But the administration, they are just, their credibility is zero now.
They're saying, give this surge a chance. We're going to do it this time.
I know. And it's gotten to the point, as you stated out earlier, where was it 10 or 11 members of the Republican members of the House of Representatives went to President Bush and said, "Sir, if there's any statements made on the war in Iraq, it can't come from you anymore because you are no longer credible." And these members of Congress are scared that they're not going to be reelected because people in their districts have finally caught on.
And yet, John, we have the Democrats who are,
yes,
afraid to cut off funding. Now, let's be clear. Cutting off funding is a very blunt instrument. It's,
right,
it's the nuclear option, but it's the only instrument the Democratic Congress has. They can, if they choose,
right,
say, no more funds.
Right.
And Mr. Bush, your time's up. You've,
sure,
run out. You have to bring the troops home. Now, what they tell me on the Hill, and I have lots of ties there based on my days working there,
yeah,
is that Bush basically said, I'd leave them there. I let him starve. Let him. He didn't use those words, but basically saying, I don't have to bring them home. You cut off the funds, you'll be the one harming our troops. In other words, he was going to play chicken with the men and women in Iraq. He was going to say, they're there, and if they don't have the funding they need, well, then it's your fault, not my fault.
Mark, in my perfect world, in John Burns' perfect world, and I said this on the Chris Matthews show a few weeks back, Chris Matthews asked me, should we cut the funding? And I said, no. I said, if I were the Democrats in Congress, I would send him the same exact bill with stricter language, with binding language. And every time he vetoes the bill, I would turn it right around on him, and I would say, Mr. President, you cut the funding off. We gave you every dime you asked for, and even more, but you cut the funding off.
But this is the game of chicken, right?
Right.
The Democrats can sponsor each bill,
and then
we still play.
And if
chicken.
I were the Democrats, okay.
We have to take a break.
Sure.
We'll get back to the issues, I promise, after the break.
Okay.
888-488-MARK, 888. We'll be right back after this.
Some people in Fairfax County don't know what public access means.
Some think it's just another channel on the dial.
But it's much more than that.
It's the voice of the people.
People like you.
Your neighbors, your friends.
Or your family.
People who want to share ideas.
Opinions.
cultures, lifestyles,
art,
sports,
music,
events, entertainment,
history,
science,
beliefs,
people who want to learn about television,
producing,
directing,
cameras,
audio,
lighting,
editing, or radio, talk, music,
whatever you think people should hear.
Public Access is the place where everyone has a voice.
And it's the place where that voice gets heard.
A place where you can create your own form of personal expression.
So what do you want to say?
Whatever it is,
you can say it here.
Because we're Public Access.
For the people.
By the people.
It is about balancing our choices between the gray of the concrete jungle and the stunning beauty of the real one. Between a stoic facade of granite and the fury of the canyon. It's why there's EarthShare, the simple way to find balance.
Denver.
EarthShare is the workplace giving program bringing the leading environmental groups under one umbrella. Support EarthShare, support them all. EarthShare. Please ask your employer about workplace giving. To learn more, visit our website. Thousands of kids in this country have everything it takes to go to college. Except the money. The United Negro College Fund. A mind is a terrible thing to waste.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're discussing the war in Iraq, what's left of it, what's still going on with it, and the morale of the troops. With my guest, he is a former Army sergeant. He signed up after 9/11 to fight for America, to fight in Afghanistan. He was sent to Iraq, and today he's fighting to help bring the troops home. John Bruton, you were saying before the break that you would, if you were the Democrat, you'd send the same bill again and again and again. Of course, we know that Democrats sent a bill saying to withdraw, setting up timetables and benchmarks. Bush vetoed it. They sent a second bill. Bush wouldn't allow that one either. Then basically Bush was saying, if our troops don't have funding, I'm going to blame you. And if the Democrats send another bill up and it's vetoed again, then you'd have the troops sitting over there without funding, and the president would be pointing fingers at Congress saying, you're making them starve, you're not giving them body armor, and Congress would be pointing their fingers at Bush saying, you're making them starve, you're not giving them body armor. And you know what? I'll tell you what some of the Democrats told me off the record, some of my colleagues in the House. Mm-hmm. On background, not off the record. I can say it, but they won't tell me who they are. They said, we were afraid that in that kind of public relations battle, the president would win it, that people would buy his argument and blame us, and meanwhile, we didn't want the troops to die.
Well, it's unfortunate, and it's politics at its worst. And as I said, you know, before the break, if I were the Democrats, I would have sent him a bill with stricter language, with binding language, requiring him to bring the troops home at a certain time, because there are various degrees. Some people want the troops out yesterday. Some people want them out tomorrow morning, but that's not a reality. A phased withdrawal is a reality. But if the president were to say, you know what, if you're not going to give me the money, I will let them sit over there and starve and point the finger at you. If I were Nancy Pelosi, if I were Harry Reid, if I were John Murtha, if I were, you know, these influential members of the Democratic Party, of the Democratic leadership, you know what I would have done? I would have gotten on every Sunday talk show. And I would have engaged in a massive PR campaign to tell the truth, to get the point across to the American people that it is not us, it is this president. And the president, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, in the supplemental, the Democrats wanted a 3.5% pay raise for the troops.
Right, good point.
A statement from the White House was that they strongly oppose a 3.5% pay raise. They want to give the troops 3%. Because it would cost, hundreds
over
of millions.
Over 5%.
Right. When, you know, they're losing, you know, billions and billions of dollars over there in Iraq that are unaccounted for.
But
that was just
thing.
So selfish.
Here's the thing.
For him to
begrudge
our troops.
Saying, yeah. And I agree with you as it happens. Yeah. But let's think about what you're saying. You're saying, in effect, they should play chicken with the president. The game where the two cars hit each other and one has to swerve. The Democrats could say, the only funding we're giving you is a funding with timetables. And he says, I will veto any bill without timetables.
Right.
And then the money runs out.
Right.
And the Democrats are saying, if the money runs, you know, we want to give you the funding, but you won't vote our way. And Bush is saying, I'm not going to accept it. And then what happens? Then the president has to take them home immediately in a, you know, quick way that's not good for the troops. Or most probably what this president would do is what Ronald Reagan did, find illegal sources of money, grab money from this program, grab money from this program, break the law, and do whatever he could. That would have been, you know, the political equivalent of a nuclear option.
Well,
that's the only option the Democrats had. They should have gone there.
Well, I believe that the Democrats should have been tougher. Now, me, I am a Democrat.
I actually agree with you. I think they should have been tougher too.
And I will continue to support the Democrats. Now, me and the you know, my business of trying to bring the troops home, I look at this as a setback, a minor setback. And I will continue to speak up, get my word out, and hopefully achieve change that way. But this president has refused to, ever since the 110th Congress was elected, he has refused to recognize them as a co-equal branch of government.
Right.
They are. They have the power of the purse. He is stubborn. He is petulant. And if he doesn't get his own way, I mean, he's clearly demonstrated what he's willing to do. And the Democrats need to point that out, to bring more exposure to it.
It's interesting because you said talked about the 3.5% pay raise. It's not pay raises, I don't think, that are causing troops to simply decide to come home. Let me play for you one last clip from 60 Minutes.
Sure.
Decision of his own.
I made the decision that I'm probably going to leave the National Guard after I get back. I'm just ready to move on with my life and be with my family, and I think I've sacrificed enough for this country.
I think I've sacrificed enough for this country. It's pretty strong words. I think you've sacrificed enough for this country, frankly.
Sure.
And yet, there is this powerful argument, emotional argument. Mm-hmm. If you bring the troops home, we surrender.
That's ridiculous. It's just, the war has gone on far too long. It has. You hear, I mean, just think, 3 years ago, this soldier that we just saw, he never would have been able to go on TV and say what he said. The troop that had confronted Senator Lieberman, he never would have been able to do that without a court-martial. This is just bulletproof evidence that the tide has turned. The American people want out. Over 70% of the American people want this war over with. President Bush just refuses to acknowledge that, and he refuses to carry out the will of the American people.
Well, he says, give the surge a chance. You were telling me...
That ship sailed, Mark.
You were telling me Iran is now giving new weapons to...
There was a report today in the Washington Post that they are arming Shiite extremists in Iraq and members of the Taliban in Afghanistan with 240-millimeter rockets that can travel 30 miles to use against our military over there. And, I mean, what are our options? How do we deal with Iran now that President Bush has broken our military?
Well, it seems that they're much stronger. I mean, here we've attacked their main enemy to their east, which was Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda, their main enemy to their west, which is Iraq, and we're fighting a two-front war. They can pretty much do what they want, build nuclear weapons or anything else.
Absolutely.
With impunity.
Absolutely.
And yet, some would say that if we leave, that shows them that we're weak, and therefore they, I mean, certainly enemies of America would, people argue, would be pleased and happy, right? They'd be cheering, and if they're happy, we shouldn't be happy.
Mark, George Bush and his administration did this. Now they are the ones that are out there saying, well, if we leave, then, you know, we show that we will show the terrorist that all they have to do is like for
Weak
example
giant and things
yeah
like that.
Yeah, if we set a timetable,
paper
then,
tiger,
yeah, that will just show that all that does is indicate to the insurgents that, you know, wait us out, and the day we leave they can take over. And it sends the wrong message to Iran. Well, maybe it does, Mark, but you know what? This is President Bush's fault.
See, I don't think he wants it to happen on his watch. I think he is determined to go to January 21st, 2009. There'll be a new president, and we'll blame him or her, and that way he can't be blamed. And if 1,000 more American troops have to die, they die. And if 10,000 more have to be wounded, I mean, after all, Bush's children aren't fighting. He himself wouldn't go into the military when he was ordered to do so. He was in the National Guard. He refused to show up.
That was his...
Doesn't really care.
By him joining the Air National Guard, he assured his avoidance of the Vietnam conflict. Vice President
Cheney... Even when they ordered him for a military exam, he refused to show up.
He refused to show up. Vice President Cheney, okay? Five military deferments. And he has not mobilized the American people. He has not gone to the college campuses and told the young Republicans for Bush, hey, maybe you guys
need to join the military.
Maybe you guys need to join the military, right. Like in World War II.
Right.
Franklin Roosevelt, he engaged in a mass mobilization of our American
people.
It's
interesting. Even the generals aren't doing it. You were telling me that the generals themselves seem to be turning against this war.
Absolutely. I mean, I was just reading a story today about Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. I mean, he just recently retired after...
Your commanding officer?
Well, he was originally, and then they made him commander of all ground forces in Iraq. And during the first year of the invasion, he took over for General Wallace. And his forecast for Iraq is very ominous. And you have General John Batiste, who commanded the 1st Infantry Division in Iraq. I mean, he came home and said, Mr. President, you've placed our nation in peril. You have General Paul Eaton. I mean, General Zinni, who
right.
ran Central Command prior to this. I mean, general after general have come out and say that this has been a disaster for our military.
Okay, so we have a few generals left. And the president has put General Petraeus in charge. He's found some general to be the scapegoat for his war czar. I forgot the name of that person. Poor guy. He'll be blamed for the surge.
General Lute.
He'll be blamed for the surge, I'm sure, in about 4 months. But General Petraeus is about to give a very important speech in September. And the word on the Hill is, from what I hear, the scuttlebutt is, that the Democrats gave 4 more months because they were told by their Republican colleagues, September's the deadline. In September, Petraeus gives his report, and then we'll be joining you in calling for withdrawal. Now, whether they're telling me that Republicans are telling them this,
sure.
I don't know whether the Republicans will actually follow through on their promises.
We can only hope.
But what will General Petraeus say in September? If he doesn't say there's progress, Bush will fire him. So doesn't he have to say there's progress?
To tell you the truth, I think General Petraeus is Bush's last chance.
What's he going to say in September?
Well,
what do you think?
I don't know that we know. It's hard. General Petraeus being a career military man, I'm very doubtful that he's going to come home and say that, you know, the war's lost and it's time for us to leave. I'm very doubtful.
So he's going to say we're making progress, and he's going to point to, we rounded up 27 people and we killed the number 3 in Al-Qaeda, who we seem to kill every 6 months.
And who knows, when he retires, maybe he'll come out like the rest of the generals and say something different.
Or maybe he'll write a book after it's all
exactly.
over and tell us what was wrong. Just got a few seconds left, John. What is the message you want to give to our listeners? Just in 5 seconds, what should they do? Contact a congressman, senator,
absolutely,
and tell them the war's over.
I would contact your congressman, senator, and tell them to do the right thing. Issue a mandate to the president to start bringing our troops home.
That's it for the Inside Scoop. Tune in tomorrow when I debate Republican on these very issues. This is Mark Levine. Signing off. Seems to slip away.